If you would, turn to Joshua 15. That song reminds me of a story. A friend of mine told me in college of a little country church where that song was led. And the song leader said, "We're going to sing this song, but we're going to make it a little more personal than it normally is. I want to make it really hit home for all of us. So when we get to the chorus, instead of singing wheel work, we're going to sing meal work." That's kind of crazy. So anyway, I always thought that was funny. Meal work doesn't quite sound grammatically correct, does it? But he thought that would help somehow. So anyway, that's not important or part of the lesson today. We are going to talk about working, though, and I appreciate Stephen leading several songs that fit with the theme of the lesson. Have you ever seen this thing? I know we all have. We probably experienced it. You might have been on different ends of it, depending on your circumstance. But have you seen this thing that happens in life where one generation really has it rough and works hard and builds something and achieves a level of success after years of doing without and sacrifice and hard work, and they're able to bless the next generation with a better life than they had growing up, but that next generation becomes spoiled and everything is too easy. And so they sort of expect life is supposed to be that way, and they think life is supposed to hand them things, and they don't appreciate the effort and work that the earlier generations have done. Whether you've lived that in your own life or you've seen it, I think we all are familiar that is a thing that happens. Maybe you've been on the spoiled end of it. Maybe you've been on the end of spoiling someone else. Or maybe you've just seen it in others. But it is a thing that happens that sometimes one generation doesn't appreciate and what they've been given, and they get kind of lazy. And I think we're going to see that very thing in the people of Israel, sadly, today when we get to that part of the lesson. We're in the study of Joshua. What's happening is that the land in this part of the book, the land is being apportioned out. The main work of conquering the enemies, the people who are living there already, has been done, but it isn't complete, as we'll see. And so the last lesson we have from Joshua, it wasn't last week, but the week before, we looked at Caleb. And remember, Caleb in chapter 14 said, "I want that hillside that I spied out 40 years ago when I was here." And that was promised to me, and he staked his claim. He said, "I'm still able to go, and I still want to go get it." Kind of a funny thing, and every now and then there's some kind of unintentional humor. This also is not related to today's lesson. But in chapter 15, I chuckled to myself as I was looking through this week. In chapter 15, verse 16, as he is, as Caleb is actually going about conquering that area that he said, "I want, that I claimed," a lot of it had been done, but there was a place called Debir. It was also formerly known as Kiriath Sefer, we're told in verse 15 of chapter 15. But in the next verse, verse 16, Caleb said, "Whoever strikes Kiriath Sefer to capture it, to him I will give Aksha, my daughter, as wife." So that was kind of a prize he offered to the man who would go up and take this place. And Othniel, we're told, verse 17, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it, and he gave Aksha, his daughter, gave him as wife. Well, I started thinking about that a little bit, and I thought, you know, that's something kind of funny, but I would love to know the rest of the story. Unfortunately, that's all we've got. But I thought, you know, that would be an interesting story to hear the rest of, because Caleb's 85. And so I was thinking, how young was this daughter that he offered? And then I thought, well, how old was this nephew of his, Othniel, the son of his brother? And wouldn't it be kind of funny to know the whole story to I was thinking, what if, you know, Othniel had always had his eye on Aksha, you know. After all these years, he finally gets her in the end by showing his breath. I don't know. Anyway, it's just funny. Who knows? We don't know the rest of the story on that. She could have been young. It could have been his granddaughter. It could have been he had other wives, or he had kids late in life. Anyway, it's not important. But I had to laugh as I tried to imagine. You could build an interesting little story about that, this love story between these two, if you wanted to. So, moving along, chapter 16. In chapter 16, we come to, they're portioning out the land to these different tribes. And in verse 4, we come to the tribes that were the sons of Joseph. Now, you remember, Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Most of the tribes are associated with one of those sons. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. But Joseph, there's no tribe of Joseph. And the reason is because Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And Joseph's father said, because Joseph was faithful and was a good boy and had, you know, all the good things about Joseph, you'll get a double portion. So each of his two sons has a tribe, the tribe of Ephraim and tribe of Manasseh. And that ends up with Joseph basically having two shares where all the rest of the brothers had one. And that was a blessing that he got for being faithful to God and faithful and you know, all the good things he did. So we have these two tribes associated with Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And the land is apportioned out to them. If you read some of the details of that, like just skim over starting in verse 4 of 16 and following down, it reads like a property deed that's written in the style of what's called today meets and bounds. So meets and bounds would be like you start in the corner of a barn on the northwest part of this and you go, you know, 15 rods west until you come to this oak tree and then you follow the creek that runs left from there. And, you know, it sort of describes the property as if you're walking along the boundary of it. And that's a style of describing a deed or a property. And this is the same thing. It says you're going to go from here and then you turn northwest to this place. You go south to there and you come to the sea and then you go north to that. And chapters of this, it's like this whole section of the book is basically a section of deeds of this property that shows how it was broken up by the tribes. This is a map that somebody put together. You can find some of them that look a little differently. Of course, some of these places, I think, are we have to kind of guess at exactly where the borders are. But this describes the Ephraim and Manasseh that was these two sons of Joseph and the land they were given. You remember, you see Manasseh over here too, twice. Some of the tribes, remember, said, we're like it over here on this side of the Jordan. We think this is a pretty good place. And so they asked if they could have permission for their land to be on that side. And there was a condition to that, remember? The condition was, you can have it, but you gotta come help us fight off the bad guys. You gotta come help us drive out the land. Oh, sure, we'll do that. So as long as you come over the Jordan and help us drive out the Canaanites, then when the work is done, you can go back over here and live on this side. And they said, great, that's what we want to do. Well, some of Manasseh did that, along with Gad and Reuben, and some of Manasseh over here. So we sometimes say the half-tribe of Manasseh. So you've got the half-tribe of Manasseh, Gad and Reuben on this side. But the part that we're looking at today, in today's lesson, is this part of Manasseh and this part of Ephraim that got this chunk of land over here on this side of the River Jordan. And that's what's spelled out in these in this document. Now, verse 8 through 10, starting with Ephraim, wraps up. And notice a little footnote that's included here that's a little bit worrying. Starting in verse 8, from Tapua, the boundary goes westward to the brook Cana and ends at the sea. Such is the inheritance of the tribe of the people of Ephraim by their clans, together with the towns that were set apart from the people of Ephraim within the inheritance of the Manassites, all those towns and their villages. However, verse 10, they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites have lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, but they have been made to do forced labor. Uh-oh. So they got this inheritance, and they had mostly cleared it out, but there were still some Canaanites there who remained, and they didn't drive them out. It tries to sort of put a little bit of a positive spin on it to say, but they were forced to do labor. So they sort of made slaves out of them, but they're still there. Is that going to be a problem, by the way? Yep, that's going to be a problem. And so we'll see that those Canaanites that stayed among them ended up being a problem later. Now, in chapter 17, we have the allotment for Manasseh. And a similar note is made at the end of it. Look down at starting in verse 11. Also in Issachar and Asher, Manasseh had Beth Shean and its villages, and Ibleam and its villages, and the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, the inhabitants of Endor and its villages, and the inhabitants of Tanakh and its villages, the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. The third is Naphath. Yet the people of Manasseh could not take possession of those cities, but the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in the land. Now, when the people of Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. That makes it sound like, I don't know exactly when they made slaves of them. It might have been later, or it might have been right away, but at some point when they were strong enough, they enslaved these Canaanites who were not driven out. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But now what is interesting is, after all this, apportioning out the land, these two tribes that were associated with Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, they've got a complaint. They say, wait a minute, we're not happy with this land we've been given. Notice the complaint in verse 14. Then the people of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, why have you given me but one lot and one portion as an inheritance, although I am a numerous people, since all along the Lord has blessed me? They're saying that this land that you've given to us is not big enough. We're a big tribe. We need more room than that. Now, apparently, they were a large tribe, but they weren't necessarily that much larger than everybody else. They just weren't content with the allotment they had been given. But they're saying, we can't all fit in this land, which is kind of strange when you look at the map, isn't it? They, ooh, it looks like plenty of room to me. But why is it this not is enough room for them? Notice what Joshua says. Verse 5, he kind of turns this on. Verse 15, Joshua said to them, if you are a numerous people, go up by yourselves to the forest, and there clear some ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you. He says, oh, you're a lot of you, are there? There's a bunch of you guys, you say? Well, why don't some of you get to work and clear off some land and clear off some of those trees? There's plenty of space. There's no problem. You know, that land over there where the Perizzites and the Rephaim are, feel free to have at it. That's basically what he's saying. Now, that's not what they had in mind. The people, verse 16 of Joseph said, well, the hill country's not enough for us. Yet the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron, both those in Bethshea and its villages and in the valley of Jezreel. They say, oh, now, wait a minute. That's not enough room. And besides, all those Canaanites, they're tough and they're strong and they've got chariots and they've got iron. We can't fight against them. Joshua, verse 17, said to the house of Joseph, said to Ephraim and Manasseh, you are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one allotment only, but the hill country shall be yours, for though it is a forest, you shall clear it and possess it to its farthest borders, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots of iron, and though they are strong. So, he's not having it. This complaining on their part is not working. They're saying, we don't have room. He said, there's plenty of room. You just got to do a little work. Oh, but there's people there. That's fine. You're plenty strong. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to clear off those trees. You're going to drive those people out. That's the answer to your problem. And he moves on, and the story goes on from there. So their complaints fall on deaf ears. They've just got their work cut out for them. What it seems to me is that the people have become sort of lazy. This generation had just had everything handed to them. In fact, hold your place there and turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Remember, it was sort of, they were warned about this similar thing in Deuteronomy 6, that they were going to have it pretty easy at first. And notice we'll read verses 10 through 12 of Deuteronomy 6. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, houses full of all good things that you did not fill, cisterns that you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees you did not plant, and when you eat and are full, take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. See, he knows there's going to be a problem. It's going to be easy in some ways. It's going to be too easy. They're going to be blessed, and in some ways they're going to be too blessed, and the tendency will be to become spoiled and forget that it is God who gave them all these things. Because you're going to move into this land. It's ready-made. Once these enemies are driven out, you just move into somebody else's house. You start eating out of their garden. You know, there's orchard full of trees that you can enjoy. It's all been done for you, and it's going to be handed to you. When that happens, don't forget about God. Well, for the most part, that's how it worked. They went in, and you remember that God did a lot of the fighting for them. Think about Jericho. They walked around it in circles, and God made the walls fall down. And God does that in other battles too, where he destroyed more people than they had to actually fight. And a lot of it was sort of handed to them, but that didn't mean there was nothing they had to do. They still had to do some fighting. They still had to show faith. They still had to do some work. So now imagine these sort of spoiled kids of Ephraim and Manasseh are given this land, and they're given what it's got, and they're saying, we don't have enough room. And he's saying, there's plenty of room. There's just trees on it. You've got to do some work. You're going to have to do something. Well, there's people there. Well, you're going to have to fight. And besides, who's going to give them the victory anyway? What were they already forgetting about when they saw those chariots of iron? They got chariots. We can't fight them. This is the same faithless people that Joshua and Caleb had gone and spied out the land with and said, oh, we can't defeat those guys. They're already forgetting about God, aren't they? They're already forgetting his power that he could give them the land. So I think the critical flaw here are two things: laziness and lack of faith. Would you agree? That's what's on display in this complaining of the people. Okay, now let's switch gears and think about that for us today. And I thought about these people and this complaining, and I was thinking, is there a lesson in this somewhere? Is there something here that we can learn from? And I wondered, maybe the more I thought about it, if we could not be like that sometimes. For instance, when we think about, let's just think about it, we can think about it in a lot of different ways. But one way we can think about it is, as a congregation, as a church, we would like to grow, right? So we might think, like Ephraim and Manasseh, you know, it'd be great if we got some growth. You know, who wouldn't want to see 20, 30, 50 more people come and be bigger and bigger and be, you know, have more young people, have classes filled up with little kids and have some more, you know, young families, have some more middle-aged folks, have some more elders and deacons, have more people. Wouldn't that be great? Don't we all agree that'd be wonderful? And some of you, I know, have memories of being here when there was a lot more people here. And so sometimes we think, that'd be awesome, that'd be wonderful. But how do we want that to happen? I think that a lot of times we would love it if that would happen the easy way. The easy way is families move into town and they're looking for a church, right? Some new family comes, like Darren and Elizabeth, or like Shannon and Haley, like we did at one point years ago. And you just say, hey, this is a good church. And you move in, it's like, boom, instant. What did we have to do for that? That was pretty easy, wasn't it? We got a whole new, you know, family that's here. And it cost us practically nothing. We're just sitting here and they fell out of the sky and they dropped into the pew. And this is great. That's wonderful. We need some more of that. So how are we going to have some more people move in here and fill this place up? That'd be nice, wouldn't it? But that's not really requiring any work on our part. That, I think, is the kind of growth that Ephraim and Manasseh wanted. They just wanted it sort of laid right out there for them. You know, I don't really want to have to do any sweat. I don't really want to have to do any work. Those trees look big. I don't want to have to cut those trees down, and those enemies are scary. And so if you could just give me some land that is ready for me to move into and doesn't take any effort on my part, that's what I would like. And I think sometimes that's probably what we would like, because it is the easy thing. Oh, it'd be wonderful if somehow people would just appear and come here and they would just join us and we would grow and that would be nice. But that's not really the way that that's, you know, probably going to happen. I mean, there could be some of that kind of growth. In fact, a lot of times today, when you see churches growing, a lot of times it is that kind of thing. It is where in a community where maybe, you know, one church is kind of lively and has a lot going on, and Christians from other churches just sort of, you know, siphon over to that place. And some people call that swelling, because in the sense of the kingdom, from Jesus' perspective, it's not really growing. It's just people moving around, you know. And so if you have one church in a community and people from other churches leave and that church grows, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm not saying it's bad, but it isn't really growing in the sense of enlarging the borders of the kingdom. It's just, you know, Christians, you know, changing where they're worshiping. And so that kind of growth isn't bad, but it isn't really the growth that the Lord, I believe, is most interested in. And I also think that sometimes perhaps we are like these, like this generation, in that we have inherited a work. We sort of step into the, we stand on the shoulders of generations that came before us. Most of us here are in the room, and not probably every one of us, but most of us came here or grew up here as a congregation that was already established and, you know, was already, a lot of the hard work was already done. And so we kind of step into that work that someone else had begun. And that's what we are, you know, continuing here. And do we have it a little bit too easy, perhaps? I remember that Jesus used this illustration when he was talking to his disciples. He said, yeah, there are 4 months and then comes the harvest. Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see the fields that are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so the sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows, another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor. And that's what I feel like I'm doing, in fact. I'm entering into a labor here that was begun by good men before me. And a lot of us are that way, that we're picking up in the middle of the process, but there was a generation before us, there were people before us who had been working, and now here we come doing our part, but we all are part of this, you know, project. But do we expect, are we that lazy generation that just wants it easy? Or are we willing to do the work ourselves of growing and spreading the gospel? So what do we got to do? Well, there's no easy answer. It's kind of like looking at that hill covered in trees. The work's out there. We just got to do it. And what is it? What kind of work do we have to do? Jesus says in John 9:4, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. This is our time. This is our generation. This is the time that we got to get to work. This is our daytime. There's coming an end to our time. So the question is, how are we going to use our time? How are we going to use the day while we have it? How are we going to get to work? Well, you might say, doing what? What are we supposed to be busy doing? In this morning's class, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, in the same way, let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. First of all, we have to be doing good. It's not just simply about teaching. It is also about being out there doing good and letting our light shine so people see the glory of God shining through us, doing things. And we talked about this morning. One of the questions that I asked you to consider was, how might we hide our light? And, of course, the answer is, if I'm not doing anything. So what kind of things would you be doing? Well, you look at like Matthew 25. You look at other places where Jesus talks about loving others, doing good to all men, especially. In fact, turn to Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. Yeah, I don't have this one on the screen. But Galatians 6, verses 6 through 10. Notice that Paul connects here showing kindness, helping and giving and doing good with sowing and reaping. We'll begin in verse 6 of Galatians 6. Let the one who is taught the word share all good things with the one who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, he will also reap. The one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. The one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. And let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially those who are of the household of faith. He's talking about sowing and reaping here, doing work and getting a reward for it. And he says, if you sow to the flesh, that means if I'm just busy taking care of me and my physical desires and needs and wants and wishes, and that's how I spend my days and my life, sowing to my flesh, then I'm going to reap corruption. That's not going to lead to anything that's going to be worthwhile. But if I sow to the Spirit, I will reap eternal life, verse 8 says. How am I going to do that, Paul? He says in verse 9, let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, especially the household of faith. This is what Jesus meant by letting your light shine. Doing good for people. Getting out there and doing stuff. Showing love and kindness as we have opportunity, as those opportunities arise. Now, is that easy work? That's hard work. It's so much easier just to me focus on me and you focus on you, and we'll just, you know, get along and not worry about anybody else. It's heartbreaking and tough and frustrating and discouraging work to get involved in helping people, in doing good. And that's why I believe he says here, don't give up. if you don't grow weary, if you don't get faint, if you don't just kind of get worn out. I tried that and I got burnt on it. I did good for somebody one time and nothing good came of it. I tried to be nice and it backfired on me. So I quit being nice. I said, forget all that. I'm going to just focus on me now. Paul said, don't do that. Don't quit. Don't give up. Don't get weary. Keep doing good. You keep doing good. What's going to happen if we do? You're going to reap. You're going to be rewarded. You're going to have a harvest of righteousness if we will keep doing good and let our light shine so that people can see God working in us and through us in the community. We should be known for being a loving, compassionate, merciful, helping kind of people. That's the hard work of serving the Lord and working in His field. To the work, as we sing. That let the hungry be fed was one of the lines in that song. And so what can we be doing to be at work? Or are we just sort of coasting along, focusing on ourselves? What is this congregation known for in the community? Do we have a reputation of people who are compassionate and motivated and helping and doing good for others? And if we are, then the light of the Lord will shine through us and people will see that Jesus is alive and well and working in our lives. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, involved in that comes with sowing the spiritual seed. That is something that we all need have a part in doing. Remember in Acts chapter 8, there arose a persecution and they were all scattered. And what happened as they were scattered? They went about preaching the word. My thing's about to die, I think. Those who were scattered went about preaching the word. So the church spread. It's good to be a good example, to let our light shine. And hopefully that will lead to opportunities for sharing our faith, for telling others about the big picture of the Bible, telling others about what is going on in spiritually and about their soul and about salvation. Is that easy work? That's hard. Is it scary? Maybe like those Ephraimites and Manassites look at those chariots of iron saying, you see those chariots those guys drive? That's kind of frightening. I wonder if it's any more or less frightening than trying to work up the nerve to have a spiritual conversation with somebody. I don't know what you'd rather do. Go tackle a iron chariot or talk to somebody about spiritual things. They're both pretty scary if you ask me. And yet, isn't that what it boils down to? Now, people have different abilities and different talents and different skills, different opportunities. And the Lord doesn't expect everybody to do the same thing. That's going to be tonight's lesson. I hope everybody will be back for how we are as a body made up of many members with different functions and different roles and different abilities. So everybody doesn't have the same ability and the same opportunities and the same responsibilities, but we can all do whatever we can do. In fact, can't we all do things like Andrew does in John chapter 1? One of the two who heard John speak when John said, there's the Son of God, was Jesus. Followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his brother Simon and said to him, we found the Messiah, which means Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. All he had to do is go tell him who he found. Hey, I found Jesus. And he brought his brother. Can we all do that? A few chapters later, the Samaritan woman, remember she figured out, Jesus said, I who speak to you am he, the Messiah. She left her water park. She brought a whole village to come see him. She didn't have to do a whole lot of teaching. She just had to be excited and motivated and tell people what she had found. And I think that's something that surely everybody can do, is to be excited and to be to tell people what we have, what we've found about our salvation, about Jesus. And, you know, you may or may not be able to lead someone in a private personal Bible study, and that's fine. There's plenty of people who would love to help with that if you had the opportunity. But surely we can all, like the bride in the end of Revelation, say, come. Surely we can all share that invitation with others. Now, I know that it's frightening, and sometimes I think people think, well, I've tried that and it doesn't work. You know, I invited people, and we've done that. And we've had door knocking, we've had handing out stuff, we did things at the fair, we've sent out letters, and we say, nobody comes. Or you try talking to somebody and nobody wants to listen. And then we might think, you know what, I don't believe this gospel works anymore. I don't know if I believe that this is going to do any good. I think it's kind of pointless. Why don't we just batten down the hatches and we'll hunker down and we'll ride this thing out because nobody cares and nobody listens. and it's just us, and that's the way it's going to be till we fizzle out. Well, what would that be showing on our part? Would that be a lack of faith? Remember what Paul said? I'm not ashamed of the gospel of God, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes. So it could be that people won't listen. It could be they won't accept the invitation. But you know what? We've done our part. If we've sown the seed, if we've offered the invitation, you can at least know that you've done your part. It is God who gives the increase. And sometimes the soil is rocky. And part of that's not our problem. Part of that's not our fault or our responsibility. You can't make people do anything. But what we can do is do our part to be busy working and trust that God has the power. Isn't that what the people of Ephraim and Manasseh needed to do? When they looked at those chariots of iron, forget about those things. Remember that it is God who is working in you and for you and on your side. And you just have to do your part. God will do his part. And I believe that's true for us today as well. It may or may not mean returning to days of 100 plus here. That's not up to us. And that we don't have a say in that necessarily. The yield, the increase comes from God. The point though is, are we working or are we lazy and lacking faith like the people of Ephraim and Manasseh? And that's the challenge. I think we could see it in them. We could see how they just want everything the easy way. And they weren't willing to do any work, they weren't willing to take any risks, and they weren't willing to show any faith. But can we see that in ourselves? And if we can, then can we determine, I'm going to do better? If we can, then let's pray about that, and let's decide this week to see if we can't be excited, and see if we can't say to someone, come. You see if we can't get out there and do some good for somebody else. Think about somebody besides ourselves. Think about a way I can be helpful. How can I brighten someone's day? How can I be there? When I have opportunities, how can I do good to somebody else whose path I cross this week so that the light will shine through you and through me? And if we can, then God will be glorified, whatever the result of it may be. Let's don't sit around waiting on things to happen. Let's get to work. This morning, if someone needs to make your life right, if you need to submit your life to Christ, to be baptized for the remission of your sins, or if you want to confess sins and ask for the prayers of the church, if there's any way that we can help you, let us know as together we stand and sing.